This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we are slated to hear from Treasurer Dr. John Kennedy. Much going on at the Capitol, as we know, regarding taxes and the budget. We'll talk with the Treasurer about the latest developments, including Governor Jindal's reversal again on the cigarette tax. He now says, no way. We'll talk with John Kennedy. Also on the show, legendary civil rights photographer Bob Adelman is scheduled to be with us. He is in Baton Rouge as part of the Louisiana International Film Festival. He has photographed many over the years and during the 1960s saw Martin Luther King up close and personal, and his work has been displayed at the Smithsonian. And Maxine Crump is slated to stop by. She is, of course, a longtime journalist and activist, and she will talk about dialogue on race education. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 877-217-5757 and 297-5633. We will keep you updated on WRKF from National Public Radio throughout the day and the night about the latest developments in Boston. It's been quite a week, and with us to start our show is Treasurer John Kennedy, and we've got much to talk to him about things permeating at the Capitol, but John Kennedy is a man who's lived in many places in this country and abroad. Good morning, Mr. Treasurer. How are you?
I'm well, Jim. I feel awfully badly, as we all do, about what's going on in Boston, but at least they found out who did it, and we'll see what happens.
Well, as far as what this means on the 18th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, is there any way to combat this sort of thing, or do we just have to grin and bear it?
Well, there's a tension here between trying to protect everybody and our individual freedoms, and it's hard to know where to strike that balance. I don't want to live in a country where everybody gets searched and everybody's in a database and government tracks your every move. On the other hand, there are some reasonable things, and I have to hope our government's doing it to try to keep us safe in these sorts of things. But at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of crazy people in the world, and there are a lot of angry people in the world, and it's hard to protect everybody from everything.
Well, as far as what's happening at the Capitol, I know you're following matters closely. Were you surprised Monday when the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Joel Robideau, pulled the plug on the tax swap?
I was surprised in the sense I didn't know it was going to happen. I wasn't surprised in the sense that it did. Chairman Robideau, in my opinion, has done an extraordinary job here of being fair to everybody. And I know there's some people disappointed with the result, but I don't think anybody can say that he didn't handle this fairly, give everybody their say. He considered all points of view. And I thought he did a great job, and I think what we heard the legislature say is, number one, they were not comfortable with the governor's proposal. Number two, the legislature at this short session didn't have time to put together a proposal of its own. But also, number three, probably most important of all, they don't think changing our tax code is the most pressing problem facing the state. They believe, as do I, that it's the budget and how we're spending our money.
There has been some reporting over the last week or so about you pushing for a central collection agency that would be, or a central collection system that would allow the state to retrieve funds that are sitting out there that are quite substantial. And I know the Attorney General wants to be a part of this, perhaps wants to lead it. What's your take on how this would work?
Well, first, I don't care who leads it, as long as we have something to lead. I've been working on this one for about 5 years, and the governor has resisted the proposal, but he's now on board, and I'm thankful for that. We keep on an ongoing basis, Jim, between $1.2 and $1.6 billion in money that is owed the state. Some of it is past due taxes, but some of it is fees that haven't been collected, fines that haven't been paid, health care bills that haven't been paid by people who could pay them. and we've done virtually nothing to collect the money. 60% of that money on an ongoing basis is always 6 months past due. Other states have centralized their collection process and put people in charge who know how to collect money and know how to have an automated system. We've never done that. The bureaucracy's always resisted it. We now have a bill by Representative Broadwater, a Republican, and Representative James, Democrat, to do that. And the folks who helped us draft the bill have estimated very conservatively that it'll bring in about an extra $158 million over a five-year period, and they say that's probably way low. So we need to do it. And I'm not saying, saying anybody's wrong the way we've been doing it. I mean, DOTD, for example, is responsible for building roads, and that's their area of expertise. They don't have any expertise in collecting money, but yet they've been in charge of their own collections, and that's true of every agency, and we can do a better job and get some extra money in, and that's what we're trying to do. And the governor has said he'll support it. In the past, he's opposed it, but this year he's on board, and I'm thankful for that.
So who collects the money? Who would be the best source to collect the money? You?
I told them up front that I didn't want it in Treasury because I didn't want anybody to think I was doing this to try to expand my turf, if you will. The way the bill is drafted right now, it would be a partnership between the Department of Revenue and the Attorney General. And my personal feeling is that's the way to do it. I'll let those two handle it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also been a report or two over the last month regarding the way we pay our citizens in Louisiana when they're owed money, and you and the governor have had a difference of opinion on this, haven't you?
Yes.
What is it?
Well, the Constitution says that the treasurer is responsible for the disbursement and custody and investment of all public funds. In the past, I've been very willing to share that responsibility with the Division of Administration. I didn't have to, but I did because I want to work with them. They've come up with a proposal, which they didn't tell me about, with Bank of America to turn over all the payments of the state to Bank of America. Let me see if I can explain how it works. I'll give you an example. When I get pay my salary every 2 weeks for being treasurer, it's automatically sent to my bank account. I don't get a check. It's just automatically sent to my bank account, and I think many people are paid that way. What the division is proposing to do, if you're a printer and you do printing for the state and your invoice is due, instead of the state wiring you the money or sending you a check, the state would send the money to Bank of America, and you'd have to go to Bank of America to get your money, and to get it, you'd have to pay a fee. That would be like if I got my monthly or my bi-monthly check for salary, instead of sending it to my account, they sent it to American Express. And for me to get my money, I had to talk to American Express, but before I could get it, I would pay them a fee. And the reason the division wants to do that is because Bank of America is going to kick back some of the money to the division. I don't like the proposal. I think it's a gift to Bank of America because our vendors are going to figure out pretty quickly, being the astute people that they are, if they've just got to pay a fee to Bank of America to get their money, they're just going to add it to the invoice. So Bank of America's going to be a big winner here, and all the rest of us are going to be big losers. I don't think we ought to do it. I don't think the division has the constitutional authority to do it on their own. They say that they're doing it because to cut down the cost of paper checks, but that's not really the reason. They're doing it because of the kickback they're getting from Bank of America. And I think there's a better way to do this, and I've asked them to hold up on it. I don't know if they're going to listen and hold up on it, but that's kind of where we are.
297-5633, a bit more time with Treasurer Kennedy. Mike on Sherwood. Mike, good morning.
Hello, Mr. Treasurer. I have a question about your previous point about the billion-plus dollars in arrears on payments and fines that haven't been collected. You said that over 5 years it would be $158 million collected. That's about, what, $6 million a year? $60 million a year? What's the program to collect going to cost? What, you know, is it a small percentage of that amount? I'll take my answer off the air.
I'm sorry. It's not going to cost us anything. We will set up the program. Basically, what we'll do is we'll have a centralized collection entity. It will use software to send out notices immediately. It has a way to trace folks if they've moved. It would be just like a centralized, in-house centralized collection agency. And it wouldn't cost us anything out of pocket because we would pay for it out of the additional collection. The $158 million is a pretty conservative estimate. CGI holds that. I think we can bring in, this is just my personal opinion, an extra $50 to $100 million a year and maybe more.
Well, as far as the budget, it looks like there's a substantial shortfall. The headline in the op-ed page of The Advocate, likely cuts when, not if. Where do we stand as far as balancing the budget?
Well, the proposed budget is not balanced. There are about $400 million worth of contingencies. Another way of saying that is pretend money that may or may not show up. If it doesn't show up, the legislature, of course, will be out of session, and the governor will get to make the cuts. And the way he's got his budget designed, he would make all the cuts from higher education. I don't like that approach. I think there are many members of the legislature who don't like that approach. It's symptomatic of a larger problem, but the point is we've had 5 years worth of mid-year budget cuts in a row, and we'll likely have a sixth if the governor's budget passes. Those mid-year budget cuts are very disruptive. If you turn to LSU with 6 months left in the fiscal year and tell them they have to cut another $10 million out of their budget, that's like a $20 million budget cut if you've got to take it over 12 months. There's a better way to do this, and I hope the legislature does it.
Now, the governor, as we know, has been against any new taxes or any renewals of taxes, and that was evidenced in the tobacco tax a few years ago. And now he proposed a $1.05 increase in cigarette taxes, and now with bills pending Monday before committees, he says he will veto any bill that includes a cigarette tax. What's going on regarding the governor's strategy?
Well, I think the governor is trying to maintain his purest record of not ever having supported a tax. I think this obsession with taxes at the Capitol is a little misdirected. If you step back and look at things from a different perspective, we're going to have $25 billion to spend next year. Under Governor Blanco, our budget was about $19 billion. Under Governor Foster, our budget was about $12 billion. I don't think our problem is how much money we have. We have more money today adjusted for inflation than at any time in our history. I think it's how we're spending the money. And I think if they would focus on that as opposed to how much we have, we could properly fund everybody. I'll give you one example, Jim. I don't know how many PR people the governor brought in for his tax reform effort. I know he needs help with his package, but he brought in an extraordinary number of PR people. I bet they're spending, you know, $500,000 a year in new salaries for all these folks that were brought in from all parts of the country. I mean, that sort of stuff adds up. You know, there. I was looking the other day at the number of consulting contracts, which we've talked about before. Every time you turn around, the administration is hiring a new consultant, and they want, under their privatization effort. All of this stuff costs money.
297-5633-877-217-5757. We've got to take a short break, 90 seconds, and we'll return with Treasurer John Kennedy after this minute and a half pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with John Neely Kennedy, the state treasurer, assumed office in that position in 2000, former revenue secretary, and also was a chief counsel for Governor Mike Foster, Governor Buddy Romer, graduate of Vanderbilt, the University of Virginia Law School, and the University of Oxford, native of Zachary, Louisiana. John Kennedy, a question from a listener regarding the Medicaid money that the governor is declining. You, on your last appearance on this show, said you didn't think the governor would change his mind. A few days ago, Governor Blanco said she thought the governor would eventually take the money. What do you think?
Governor Blanco could know something I don't know. It's entirely possible, but I do not think the governor will change his mind. I think it probably has to do with his national ambitions. I'm not saying he's right or wrong. I don't see how anybody can make this decision until we know what our health care delivery system is going to look like, and we don't. The state of flux because of the public-private partnerships about which we know nothing.
So would you do the same thing Governor Jindal is doing?
I have no way of knowing. I mean, you can't – this is like saying I'm going to build a new house, but before I get it finished, I'm going to start talking about an addition to it. We're in the process of building a new house, Jim. We're turning over every public hospital to a private hospital. Nobody at the Capitol knows any of the details. Nobody knows – We think we know who the players are, though they change quite a bit. We don't know how much it's going to cost us. We don't know what population will be served. When the legislature asks for the details, the governor says no, he's not going to tell them, and they're not going to even get to approve it. Until we know what the end result is, I don't see how the governor or anybody else can make a decision about expanding the program when we don't know what a program we have to expand.
John in Goodwood. John, good morning. You're on with Treasurer Kennedy. Hello, John.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, you're on the air.
Mr. Secretary, John Engelsman.
Hey, John.
The Stelly plan was never given a chance to work. We voted it in. We, the people in the legislature, voted it out. They finally shown a little independence with regard to the what was, in my opinion, a very foolish plan to eliminate the income tax. Why not reinstate the Stelly plan? Why doesn't the legislature have enough guts to do that? Wouldn't that solve a lot of our problems?
Well, I will tell you what I think we ought to do, and what I hope the governor does. After this session, I would like to see him wait about 6 months and then call a special session. And in that 6 months, I would do the groundwork involving the Legislative Fiscal Office, the Legislative Auditor, PAR, and CAPLE. And the purpose of the special session would be to review every single one of the exemptions that we have made to our income tax, our sales tax, and our excise taxes. We have 468 special rules that say a group of people or a group of companies don't have to pay taxes. The rest of us do, but they don't. Now, that those exemptions may make sense. Maybe the purpose is to stimulate an industry to create jobs. But we need to go back and examine why we created those exemptions or exceptions and whether they're doing their job, and if they're not, we ought to get rid of them. If we did that, we would flatten the tax code, and we could talk about reducing the rates, whether it's income, sales, or excise.
Let's see. Kevin, we've got Dorothy in Goodwood. Dorothy, good morning. You're on with Treasurer John Kennedy.
Good morning. Two questions. First off, Bank of America, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't even have branches in Louisiana. And number two, why don't we tax alcohol, a nickel a drink? That would solve some problems.
That might raise too much money. I don't think our problem is revenue. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I think it's our priorities. In terms of Bank of America, I don't mean to pick on Bank of America, but they were picked for this proposal. They didn't bid it out. They just picked Bank of America. I didn't like that. I don't think that's fair. I do think they ought to consider Louisiana banks. And you're right, Bank of America does not do business in Louisiana, Mississippi, or Alabama. If we're going to do this, and I'm not sure we ought to do it, we ought to at least talk to the Louisiana banks, in my opinion.
297-5633, a few more minutes with John Neely Kennedy, who is a state treasurer of note, having held the office now for, 13 years? That's hard to believe, but that's a reality. Any thoughts about running for governor?
I expect to be on the ballot next time. That's about as far as I've gotten. I may run for reelection. I may not. I just really haven't thought about it, Jim.
Okay, which means you might run for governor.
You know, I really haven't made any decisions. It's a long ways away, and I'm really more focused on our problems right now. And it's no secret I'm very worried about our universities.
Well, and the budget is such that the universities are in peril. And you say we have a spending problem, not a revenue problem, but there are ways to raise revenue, as you know, that probably would be palatable with most of the legislature and the public at large, a cigarette tax increase being one of those ways. But the governor has taken this oath that he signed with Grover Norquist that he will not be in favor of any new taxes. And by virtue of that, some would say Grover Norquist is running the state of Louisiana right now. What do you think about those who have that point of view?
You know, one of the reasons I like your show, Inkster, she has great questions. You really do. I don't know about the governor's conversations with Mr. Norquist. I don't know about any of that. I don't talk to Bobby very often. This is my personal opinion. We've got enough revenue. It's how we're spending the revenue that is our problem, and we're spending money on things that are less important than the things that are being starved to death. And that, to me, is the discussion to have. I would rather spend money on our universities than hire all these 19,000 consultants they're hiring. We do not need all of them. I understand the concept of privatization, but I don't worship at the altar of privatization. The governor's big on privatization. Sometimes it's the right thing to do, but it's not always the right thing to do, and we're spending this enormous amount of money on these out-of-state consultants, and I'm not sure we're getting much value. I think we ought to review every one of those contracts, and we could eliminate some and save a whole lot of them. Mm-hmm. I'm talking hundreds of millions of dollars, in my opinion.
Well, I've stated on this show so many of our leaders have never worked in the private sector, yet they have this love for the private sector. You've been in the private sector. It's a sector that's fraught with benefits and drawbacks like the public sector. It's not a panacea, is it?
No, but the private sector does have two rules for cash flow and operating business that government could follow. They're pretty simple. Number one is don't spend more than you take in. And number two, when you do spend money, spend it on things you really need, not just things you want. Prioritize your spending. For the last 5 years, the state of Louisiana has been violating both of those rules, and it's why we have the problems we have today, in my opinion.
So we're getting closer and closer to June 6th when the legislature shuts down. According to my math, that's 48 days away. What's going to happen in the next 7 weeks?
We're going to find out whether we have an independent legislature. I mean, the governor's thrown down the gauntlet. He says, I have totally restructured health care in Louisiana. I don't know. I can't tell you about it yet. But once it's finished, you can't vote on it. It's my decision and my decision only. The legislature has said, no, we want the right to approve it. We will find out whether the legislature will stick to its guns. We spend $9 billion a year out of a $25 billion budget on health care. In my opinion, and under the Constitution, the legislature has every right to be involved in that decision. And indeed, some can argue that it is solely their decision. But we're going to find out.
Well, we look
and it will have a huge impact on the budget.
Mm-hmm. We will follow the process with you, and thank you, as always, for joining us today, Treasurer John Kennedy.
Thanks, Jim.
Have a good weekend. Take care. We're joined in studio now, first by Maxine Crump, who's been with us a few times, the legendary journalist. And I think that adjective is accurate. Good morning, Maxine. And yesterday you got a nice award from the National Association of Black Journalists, the Baton Rouge chapter. It was long overdue, but
thank you. You it's quite an honor.
Are a pioneer at LSU. She was the first African-American to live in a dorm at Louisiana State University and one of the first African-Americans to be a reporter in Baton Rouge, right?
Yeah.
Well?
It was quite an honor.
Yeah, yeah. Well, before we get to the topic about dialogue and race, which she's been intricately involved with in the last several years, as far as how the environment was for a black reporter with your colleagues and with the public at large, how was it when you were first sent out on the streets of Baton Rouge?
There was so you have to think about the times that I was in. It was really sort of a lot of people were doing being the first.
Mm-hmm.
And so being the first at Channel 9, in my mind, wasn't as much of being the first as I was among many who were being the first in different things. And that I had, maybe it was a surprise to the people that saw me, but this sort of thing had been in my mind, not for me, but in the minds of those who had been in this movement all my life. I had known that there was a movement to have all people of color included in all parts of America, that this set aside or this caste system and this divide was not proper. And I saw myself as just doing my part. And when I went into Channel 9, I didn't have any background. And so it was my fear, gee, I'm here. I got to do this job.
Mm-hmm. Well, yesterday, Maxine led another dialogue on race, and this one focused on education. And of course, race permeates every facet of our lives, and education is one of those where it's most prominent. There were many people who were there, including a guest we'll hear from in a few moments. But what was the basic conclusion, if so, that you came forward with after hearing these people express their points of view?
Okay, well, let me say first off, Lisa Teer is not one of the guests from the panel. She was on the committee. We did not get one of the guests to come, but Lisa Teer and I... And I want to say first, it was Lisa's idea. She's with mm-hmm. Delta Service Corps. She brought the idea to Dialogue on Race Louisiana, and we together added more people to the committee and carried forward. And you're saying, what's the conclusion from the? Well, actually, Lisa brought three of the evaluations from yesterday, and it was just a sampling that people thought it was fantastic. It was about time, and that they had been to things like this before that had been surface. And that was said to me by some people, and then I see it written in an evaluation. So we were not surface in our program yesterday.
Well, we talk much about these issues, but sometimes the action is not accompanied after the talk or with the talk. So what can we do to spur people into action with the words that are expressed about concerns in education and particularly the racial divide that we have in this community regarding education?
Well, let me go back to something that is significant, is that the people who were there said they had been used to surface talk. So all the talk didn't bring action because it was surface talk.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first time in the history of Baton Rouge that there has been a dialogue about education that dealt with the underlying race component. The school system started as a race issue without it being called an issue. If you start your schools all white and you have other people of color in your community and they're not included at all, and yet their tax money is paying for these publicly funded schools, that's racism. So the schools started out as a racist construct. And then when Judge John Parker said, all people have to be included in these schools. And then there were other institutional systems that whites were able to use to avert or divert away from this federal ruling.
Well, there are public schools in this city that are better than others and have more resources than others and are much whiter than others. There aren't that many blacks at the lab school at LSU. Why not? There's some, but not many.
You know, LSU was started out as a white college. Mm-hmm. And Southern was started out as a black college, and it was an after effect that there was a Southern at all because of racism, that there were no education for blacks, and they couldn't go to the white school that taxes were being paid for. Blacks were paying taxes for LSU and couldn't go. So now we have to open a school for blacks because you don't want them to go there. So do you really think those two schools are going to end up having integrated high schools?
Well, they're supposedly public schools, right?
Exactly right. So the system needs to ask itself the question, not Maxine have to answer it. The system needs to answer for that.
Well, why isn't the system addressing this?
That's a great question. That's what we're trying to do. And I think a lot of people there indicated that they wanted some answers from the system. And before we left, someone came to the mic and said, we'd like to start a movement to mm-hmm. have systemic address to these problems and not continue to ask parents and homes and individuals to answer these questions. These are systemic problems. It was created systemically. It needs to be solved systemically, but it needs us to push for it.
And, of course, there are other schools that are almost 100% African-American in this community that are public schools. Wasn't the idea to have a balance that would be reflective of the community at large?
That idea was there. That was what the ruling was about.
Well, it doesn't seem to have worked out that way, does it?
Right. So how do you explain white flight, and how do you explain that part?
All right. Well, Lisa Teer is also with us, and as Maxine stated, Lisa, who's with Delta Service Corps, was a primary mover and shaker in this Dialogue on Race Education Forum that took place yesterday. What was your impression about the speakers and the viewpoints that were enunciated?
Thank you, Jim. I was incredibly impressed with the panel that we had put together, the videos, and then the participation. You could hear in the audience just these audible gasps sometimes and just laughter and then just cheers and some clapping. And so that was really exciting to be a part of. Mm-hmm. I think it was a very successful day. I'm very mm-hmm. proud of it. It was great.
I heard a story on WRKF this morning that over 60% of our schools in this community are D or F rated. That's not very good. Is that a byproduct of some of the issues that were discussed yesterday?
I think so. I think in general it's a lack of resources, or it's not maybe even not a lack of resources, but a disproportionate allocation of resources.
Well, who can make that better? Who's responsible for driving the train to make this a better situation?
Well, I guess all of us are, all the community members. I mean, people who send their kids to private schools think that they don't have to, that they don't have a stake in it, but I would disagree with that. I think we all have a stake in public education. It's the foundation for everything in our society.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. May you also reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. And we will return with Maxine Crump and Lisa Teer for a few more moments right here on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Maxine Crump and Lisa Teer are with us. They were involved in Thursday's Dialogue on Race Education, a day-long forum involving people who are certainly engaged in our community about where we are regarding the educational system and how this is viewed through the lens of institutional racism. Bobby in Mid-City. Bobby, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I was fortunate enough to attend on yesterday, and it was one of the most powerful symposiums I've attended, and very honest. I have a question. This morning we hear that the south end of the city is looking to, again, move away from the school system. And I would just like to see if Lisa and Maxine might have any suggestions on how we might move forward with another part of the city moving away, and what would that do to those who are left?
Maxine?
One of the things that Press Robinson brought out was that when he was on the panel, and that one of the when he was trying to negotiate, according to what the judge said, to get together and have the school board come up with a plan that in all of the negotiations about the planning, it seemed like there were at least four board members who insisted on not going along and that won over. And that he thought at that point that when they couldn't go forward with to agree on anything, that he saw this breakaway thing happening and that it's happening just in the order that he saw it. Baker, Central, Walker, and now Southeast.
How prevalent is discrimination in this community today? You've seen advances.
But... Well, you measure by results. Yes, a lot of people love to talk about advances here, while other people are suffering from the lack of resources, suffering with crime in 70805, and that's not our problem. We just move away. Where 70805 was historically the area that whites were very proud to be in, and now that this white flight has left it in poverty, impoverished, and crime-ridden, and long-term poverty and concentrations of poverty lead to high crime. That's statistically known.
Well, the life quality of people in this community can be affected by how we view other people. And discrimination of all kinds, against women, against blacks, against gay people. Is Baton Rouge behind the curve on this, Maxine?
Very much so. I can answer that very directly. I mean, almost anybody in Baton Rouge can tell you that there's a race dividing line in Baton Rouge, that on the south side, predominantly white, and on the north side, predominantly African American, and that there are very few communities in this area that show any real diversity, race diversity.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Maxine Crump and Lisa Teer, and we're joined by Representative Thomas Carmody. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Maxine. I had a quick question. Would we be better served in moving forward with the state to eliminate a school that differentiates between white and black students? And the reason I ask that question is this. Then do you move to close the schools? And that's going to offend some people, because they're called historically black colleges for a reason. And that reason might not be one that we want to reflect on, other than the fact that there is some ownership in that institution by everyone. But I don't, as an LSU graduate, look at my alma mater as being a white institution. I never saw it like that. But I understand what you're saying the history was, but are we better started moving forward? And at this point, I'll hang up and let y'all answer. But thank you for letting me call in.
Well, you didn't have to look at LSU as a white school. You didn't have to look at yourself as white. You were just able to see yourself as a Baton Rougean and an American. And that is great. I think that's what we all need to be able to see ourselves as Louisianians and American, and that our differences in the way we look needs to just be the way things are, and it needs to be okay. But we do have a caste system. And fortunately, you didn't have to think about it. But now, unfortunately, because you and people like you didn't have to think about it, it looks like we're all okay because you're looking through your eyes. But we're not all okay. We have a very systemic problem with our education. And your question of whether we should shut down schools and penalize schools, I think what we did yesterday was a key part of what we need to do. We need to historically know what happened. And one of the things we know that happened is that African Americans paid for taxes for many, many years for schools that did not allow African Americans. And now whites are saying, why should we have to pay for schools that don't serve us? And so you have the power to not deal with that. Whereas for many, many years, hundreds of years, blacks had no power against that. So now I think whites need to really realize how much privilege they've had and take some ownership for rectifying this by understanding the history. And those who didn't come yesterday will still be asking questions like you. Well, should we make a knee-jerk reaction? No. Most of our desegregation came through knee-jerk reactions without understanding the history, put poorly trained teachers in, young, unprepared to deal with African-American children and the culture of African-American and the deprivation that had gone before. And some of that is part of the failings that have happened with the school system. Not teachers that weren't good, but teachers that weren't prepared to handle desegregation that was thrown on schools and forced them to have to deal with it. Now, I think no knee-jerk reactions should happen at all. Lisa, you have any thoughts on that? I know you do.
No, I absolutely agree. I look at the Jim has the LSU reveille there, and I think you don't consider LSU a historically white college. You don't, when you talk about LSU, that's not what right. you say.
Well, today in the reveille, and they've done some groundbreaking stories of late, and the latest is regarding the prospect of a gay football player, or two, or three, or five, or 10, or 20. How many? I'm sure there have been gay football players at LSU, but none have come forward. Alfred Blue, senior running back, star player, Hahnville. This is his quote about the possibility of a gay teammate. He says, football is supposed to be this violent sport, this aggressive sport that grown men are supposed to play. Ain't no little boys out here between them lines. So if you gay, we look at you as a sissy. You know, like, how are you going to say you can do what we do and you want a man?
Says a lot about how we need to change our perspectives.
Well, as I say, discrimination against black people quite often is coupled with discrimination against women. It's coupled with discrimination against gay people. If you're a black gay woman in Baton Rouge, I would imagine life could be a bit challenging.
A bit.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Maxine Crump. Always provocative, and certainly look forward to hearing from you again soon. And congratulations to you and Lisa on your fine forum yesterday.
300 people. We're quite happy.
Well, you did well. And we thank you for being with us and sharing your story. 297-5633 is your number, and this is the time of the season right now in our community for the Louisiana International Film Festival. And one of the gentlemen who has made his way to Baton Rouge to be part of this is one of the fabulous photographers in the world, Bob Adelman. He is here to talk about his work, and tonight he will be on display at the Old State Capitol with his work. And Bob is sauntering into the studio. And he is a man who is quite familiar with the mover and shaker and leader of the International Film Festival here in Louisiana, who's been with us before, Chesley Himesfield. Good morning, Bob.
Morning.
Well, you were there, as I stated before. You were there in Birmingham and Selma in Washington. You were by Martin Luther King Jr.'s side at Malcolm X's speeches and his funeral, in the trenches, in the marches. How was that experience?
Well, it's still vivid. This is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. So I, coming back here to Baton Rouge, I was very active in local politics, I guess. I don't know if you're familiar with the efforts by blacks to get the vote 50 years ago. But it was something called Freedom Summer.
Well, 1963, yes. August 28th, Martin Luther King gives his I Have a Dream speech. You were there?
Oh, yes. It was, well, people in the movement knew that he was an extraordinary speaker, but I think he surpassed himself. Was covering the crowd. I was there as a volunteer, actually, but I found the my way. I sort of inched my way up the stairs because I knew his speech would be the great moment in the march.
What kind of a shot did you get of him? I'm sure you took several photographs that day.
Well, I was there. We used to say in the movement, when the spirit says move, you move. And I was there to try to catch that spirit. But when he spoke, I was trying to see a moment where he was how should I put this? He was not a really very photogenic fellow. He was short and had a round face. I mean, it sounds funny now, but when he spoke, he really reached out to people, and I shot him waiting for this moment when he was reaching out, his peroration, and when he said "free at last," and that's it's a side view with his arm out.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the most famous photographs of the day.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Well, you said he wasn't the most photographic man. Who are some of the most photographic?
Photogenic,
people,
yes.
Well, no.
The problem, it's not that he wasn't a handsome man or something. He was a short fellow, and he had a round face. But when he spoke, and as we all understood, he was one of the most soulful people of our time. And to try to catch his inner soulfulness, that's what the problem was.
Well, for example, the president. President Obama, he seems like a photogenic man.
Yes, he is. Yes. I haven't photographed him, so I can't tell you what the problems are, but he tends, I've heard from some, he's a little bit robotic in when cameras are around.
Really?
Well,
he seems to be comfortable before a microphone.
Yes. He's one of our great,
But some people, when they know they're being photographed, they don't really respond well to posing for pictures, and your best shots are when people are not posing, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I am not bad at taking portraiture, but my best and most vivid photographs are people in action. For instance, the Birmingham water hosing, which is completely. Do you know that photo?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. That's your photo?
Yes.
Your work's been in the Smithsonian?
Oh, yes. I've photographed for every major magazine in the world. And the movement was a way of getting into the media. But then I went on to photograph many of our great artists. And
Andy Warhol?
Yes, that's right. I took a very famous picture of Andy at the... I took him into a Gristides. Now, that was a posed picture. But he walked around Gristides, which was a grim little store, and saying, "Beautiful." He really... I thought he was putting me on, but he really loved pop culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, the exhibit that you're most... well known for is Mine Eyes Have Seen. It vividly tells what life was like and the evolution and experience of the civil rights movement. Many of those photographs will be on display here in Baton Rouge for a while, starting tonight, right?
Yes, in conjunction with the film festival, which is, I guess, a great event here. I think this is a sort of new adventure for Baton Rouge, and I'm going to speak tonight and try to give some insight into some of the people I photograph.
Now, the time I have is 8 o'clock. Is that correct? Is that right, or do I have the time wrong?
I think it's supposed to be 6 o'clock.
All right, you would know better than I, so I wouldn't want anybody to miss it, but it's at the old state capitol, so yes. They would know. So if... anyone has an interest in going, and I'm sure there are some.
You have a wonderful voice, you know. I'm a northerner, but I really enjoy hearing that very kind of musical.
Well, thank you very much. I sound just like Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, don't I? You have that famous shot of him shaking hands with Prince Arnold, the black sheriff of Wilcox County.
Oh, you know that picture.
Yeah, how did you get that one?
Well, the reason it's sort of interesting is because black politicians before the civil rights activities would never shake hands with blacks. But, we're now, 40 years later, all that's possible. Shelby, I've done a book in Alabama called Down Home, and I go back there, and Shelby was visiting the various counties that in the Black Belt, and so the sheriff and he just naturally shook hands. I didn't oppose it. It was
a good shot, though. As many in the career of this remarkable gentleman have been, Bob Adelman, and he's done photographs for the covers of Esquire, People, Time, Life, New York, Harper's, Newsweek, New York Times Magazine, Fortune, American Heritage, the London Times, a lot of places. And tonight, many of them will be on display. I'm told it is 6 o'clock, Old State Capitol. Bob Adelman, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Hope everybody has a great weekend, and we shall return Monday. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.